This is work I've been doing in collaboration with my colleagues at Nottingham and also at Citrix, although they're not on the author list. To give you a bit of background, we've been getting very frustrated over the last few years with centralized cloud hosted services. So I'm from the group that did a lot of work on OS virtualization. So we did the work to build these isolated centralized services. And then, of course, things like Amazon and general platforms and service things took off. And they've been becoming popular with just frightening speed. So these days, the biggest problem we have is that these services come and go, they become very, very popular, they take lots of people's data, and then they disappear. And they disappear for various reasons. They can be shut down for political reasons, as we've had lots of talks about, but also just simple commercial reasons. And so who remembers things like Orkut and Friendster, and the number of cloud services just disappear? So. Oh, is Orkut still going?
I think so.
Oh, my word. Wow, that's a surprise. I got added to some Smiles Too Much group in Orkut. I wonder if I'm still on it. One of the things I've been doing for a long time is running my own domain. So I run a little server for the last 15 years called recall.org, and this is where all of my personal data goes. And over the years, it's running its own AS, it hosts email services and so on, and it's become a real resource for friends and family. So out of interest, how many people here run their own little services? Interesting. So even in this group of people who care about this sort of thing, it takes a lot of manual effort to keep these services going. It's pretty much what taught me computer science as I go along, is maintaining one of these nodes in the internet and trying to keep my data under our control so that we can establish control of it. So the goal of our project is to try to figure out how do we get access to these kind of self-hosted services that you own in such a way that a non-technical user can use it. So we want to take, say, for example, myrecall.org or monkey.org, which is another famous example, and try to give that out to the non-technical person so they don't have to depend on centralized services. The other thing in the background, of course, is that we're trying to defeat the global passive observer. So if everyone controls their own services, we want to provide a much harder surface area for global passive observers to record traffic. So we want to enable ubiquitous encryption across these services in such a way that there's no one centralized target to attack. And finally, it's a simple matter of usability. So if you're going to work offline, you want to make sure that these services will work when my broadband is disconnected, and so on and so forth. So it's not just a case of security and longevity. We also want to increase the latency of these services in such a way that you want to connect to local systems, including mesh nets, such as the ones we heard earlier in the day. So this brings us to what we're actually doing. And what we're doing is, in some sense, was described as a simple hack by John Crowcroft, and it's turned into a three-year project, which is, how do we use the DNS to enable us to all have our own personal domains? We want every human being on the planet to have their own domain. And then this will enable us to have a personal cloud. And what a personal cloud is simply a set of resources that you own and you control, and you can access by doing DNS lookups that give you addresses that are under your control and let you route to your own storage and computing resources. And crucially, we want to do this by not going over the internet. We want to build our own internet, our own routing protocols, but have them as simple to use as existing DNS-based systems are. So if I go to facebook.com, I go to some centralized data center controlled by Facebook that's actually very distributed. And similarly, we want to figure out how do we deploy these for every individual across the edge network. So it seems pretty simple, and there's been a number of projects, some pretty high profile, trying to do this, and they've all failed for various reasons in terms of usability or some security aspects. And there's a kind of an emerging Zuku's triangle for these systems. So we have to make trade-offs between compatibility with existing applications, between the security of these nodes, because we have to deal with key management and so on, and actual simple connectivity. So the cloud, for example, really makes it simple to be compatible with existing services and to deal with security by providing centralized identity, but it really fails in edge connectivity. So if we all wanted to form a simple local network here, it's actually quite hard for us to coordinate because we have no way of even naming our devices, which are all very anonymous in the network, and actually talk to each other. So we're trying to figure out if we're gonna orchestrate all of this connectivity, what is the minimal network infrastructure we need to give to people on the internet in such a way that we're representing users on the core network, but not actually sending all their data through there. We just simply want to have these little conductors everywhere that will require minimal management and work across the whole internet. So why is all this so hard? And the problem is the core network is actually, you know, it's been engineered for solidity. We can communicate with Google with incredible uptime these days. Anycast has been widely deployed so that as soon as you get to the network core, it works pretty well. On the edge, things are a complete train wreck. So we've lost end-to-end connectivity because NATs, for example, have just prevented us from, at the IP address layer, from just referring to other devices. So if anyone in this room has a unique local address, someone in another network obviously has a similar local address and cannot communicate. So packet filtering and in general NAT have made tunnel setup extremely dynamic. We've got to figure out local environment, figure out who in the edge is kind of messing around with our packets, and then do some probing. So it's already quite a manual effort to set these things up. The second thing, of course, is if anyone goes to a coffee shop or goes to the room in the lobby, middle boxes are everywhere. So anything we do in the edge before you get to the core network is vulnerable to redirection proxies and Wi-Fi targets and so on. And these also require traversal and some kind of automated process to get around. And finally, and this is really tied to the dark nets, multipass is on almost all of our devices. So at any point when you want to open a connection to the cloud, you've got to figure out, well, do I use my 3G network, or do I use my Wi-Fi, or do I use some other connection? Do I use Bluetooth, which almost no one does, but we still have the capability. And somehow you've got to make all of these choices when you just want to connect two devices together. And depending on your context, the right choice is not obvious. So we need to figure out how to automate all of these decisions within the network somehow. And so this is why we choose to build on DNS. So why do we choose to build in DNS? Well, it's the standard for naming on the internet. It's supported in pretty much every device out there. So if you can figure out some solution that works over the DNS, then all you have to do is just type a name to your browser or you know, configure your embedded ARM device, and it'll just work. And crucially, it's also naturally hierarchical and cacheable. So it meets all of our properties that we need for example, working offline, because it's cacheable or you can terminate it at the edge, you don't actually need to run DNS as a centralized service, although it largely is out on the internet. And another crucial fact is that it's the one protocol that works almost everywhere, even if IP connectivity itself doesn't work. So for example, if you're in a Wi-Fi hotspot, DNS resolution requests go through, you actually have an information channel, but you can't make any TCP connections because they're blocked until you authenticate. But you actually do have this really nice side channel, and a lot of people use DNS over, IP over DNS proxies to let them work through these Wi-Fi hotspots when perhaps it's against the terms of service. But the resolver infrastructure works everywhere that there's a network connection in a way that TCP and IP simply don't. And even if there's censorship boxes, they tend to blacklist services and not really, they don't, if you have your personal domain, for example, they'll invariably just go through, whereas well-known services such as Google or Facebook might get blocked. So what does this look like? What is the actual user experience we want? Well, I've got my central host, Recall.org. It's been there for a very long time. And you can do a DNS lookup, and you get a stable IP address. This IP address is in the core of the network. So what we want is, for example, if I have a stronger DNS binding, I want to take all of my devices and give them names. So our devices right now are languishing by not having names. So all of our devices, our computers in the network, are actually anonymous. They're requesting DSP leases, and they don't have a globally addressable name. So what I want is when I type in, for example, ipad.home.unyield.recall.org, which is my rather unwieldy but predictable long-term name, it figures out exactly how to get to my iPad, and it returns an IP address that just works. And this magic needs to happen in the network somehow. But notice that the address it gives back is a link local address. It's a private IP address. Because if I'm right beside my iPad, if my iPad is, which is in my bag there right now, I should just get a local address. And if I'm further away, the network should figure out how to get me a connection to that iPad and give me back an IP address that works. So this is really what we want. We want stronger bindings to DNS. So all of this requires a lot of fiddling with the DNS. And you think that when we showed this to IETF on the HomeNets community, there was a little bit of, what do you want to do with DNS? You're turning this into some kind of a control network. It's a bit like a botnet control network. Is that a really good idea? But luckily, just even a cursory reading of the DNS spec shows that this is not only permitted, it's almost encouraged by the spec. Because they say that, well, DNS servers can play games in RC 3234. And you just have to deliver a syntactically correct response. That is, the IP address that you get back or whatever result record you get back should be correct. But how it calculates that is really up to the server itself. So what we're doing is building a new breed of DNS server that has a lot of smarts in there and can figure out the routing protocols required to respond. And once you do that, the responses seen by the clients should just work. So what this is turning into is therefore saying that the unit of ownership on the internet should almost be a domain name. Because you can't really own anything else on the internet. I can rent a cloud service like Facebook. I don't actually pay them, but advertising pays for it. But when it comes to owning something, registering and purchasing a domain name is actually the one thing I can own, and then I can start registering stuff underneath that. So we really want to make DNS, which traditionally has been a very infrastructure service, available to the average person. So, for example, with a personal registrar, I should be able to buy Recall.org in the modern age, register it, and start registering my devices under there and make it work. And so once you do this, once you just enable and open up DNS, all the other services like mesh nets and alternative internets become so much easier to build. And this is really the goal of Signposts. There's two big missing things. When we started building this, I actually started building this in 2002 first as a quick hack, and DNSSEC wasn't really allowed, wasn't really present. So crucially, if you want to have one of these DNS hierarchies, it's a natural place to also do identity. Because when I have recall.org, I also want to strongly suggest that recall.org is owned by me. And so DNSSEC has been getting more and more established as a globally deployed root of trust. Now, there's lots of criticisms of DNSSEC, but it does have the good property that it's out there and it works, and it's an alternative to SSL, which in many ways is even more broken. But it does provide us with a distributed trust chain that we can actually get into and use today and actually deploy. There's a big problem with DNSSEC, though. And DNSSEC doesn't do confidentiality. It only guarantees that your particular connections are signed and verified as coming from that particular user. And so when we built the second prototype of the system about 2 years ago, we had all kinds of hacks where we tunneled the security protocols of the DNS to give you confidentiality and so on. But meanwhile, Dan Bernstein was busy hacking away on DNS Curve. And DNS Curve gives you point-to-point DNS security. So it is almost the perfect complement to DNSSEC. Because where DNSSEC gives you a trust anchor that you can identify people with, DNS Curve just lets you set up a point-to-point connection, and it gives you confidentiality to your lookups. It lets you repudiate a lookup, so you can deny you ever made it, and it also gives you integrity and authentication on the actual control level. So between these two things, we should be able to have confidential lookups and actually identify the other end all through the existing DNS resolver infrastructure, which is kind of incredible because it means that with no other things except for all of our hundreds of millions of resolvers out there, we should be able to have a very secure coordination channel across the existing internet. So what does this actually look like in practice if you're building one of these things? So let's start up with a device. So we're saying that all of our devices, let's assume, for example, I've taken my mobile phone, I've got an Android here, and let's assume we can modify it. So we have various bits of our prototype where you can work with unmodified devices like an iPhone. I do apologize for the small font there. The slides are online on my Twitter account if you want to access them. But the basic idea is simple. We override the DNS resolver in the device. And so every DNS lookup that you make will go through a signpost service on the device. And the lookups will bind to a little node, a home node, on the network somewhere. So the idea is that we all have a little signpost that we trust, that we own uniquely, and all of our DNS resolvers, DNS resolution requests go through this DNS curve interface. So when you go through this DNS curve interface, it means that all of the lookups I do have essentially outraced any bad guys on the network, because rather than using someone's existing ISP resolver, I've introduced a little shim as early as possible, so that I, as a good guy, because you know I try not to kind of betray myself, can actually encrypt my DNS lookups and send them to a trusted node in the network before they can get intercepted by bad guys. Now, crucially, what this signpost can do is, that in response to this lookup, it can start reconfiguring the network such that its response is suitable for your needs. So whenever I do a DNS curve lookup, say for example to my iPad, it goes, hey, well, I know who made this request because it's been source authenticated, and then it'll start setting up tunnels over IP, TCP, UDP by doing dynamic probing. And this crucial thing, this effectful resolution, is what lets the edge magic happen. So this signpost node is responsible for taking care of reconfiguring the network to make sure that it just works in response to my lookup. Now, of course, having just one signpost is a bit lame, because who knows where I am in the network? So we have this model where our signpost servers have a eventually consistent reconciliation protocol. And this is very simple. It's just a gossiping protocol right now. But the model is that we just deploy these tiny little ARM signpost devices anywhere that's appropriate in the network. So for example, I have one at home running on a Raspberry Pi. I can put one in the cloud as a tiny little service, or one on my laptop, for example. And these edge services all act as nodes in the network that can run commands on my behalf. So if I need to set up a tunnel, or I need to set up some kind of a NAT punch, well, these are trusted devices that run the network and do things on my behalf, but they never see my data. They're simply coordinating all of my infrastructure. And finally, if I need to talk to someone else, which I occasionally have to do, then what happens is that we use DNSSEC as a trust anchor across all of these signposts. So just by doing a DNS lookup, if it's within my domain, then my signpost cloud will run and do its internal resolution. As soon as they need to talk to someone else, they can establish by doing normal DNSSEC public key lookups what the signature of the other person is, and then do signpost-to-signpost communication. So we're using DNSSEC at the very top level as a trust anchor. We're using the edge network as a point-to-point network that can do confidential lookups between our devices. And then finally, we have these edge devices that simply do lookups and use a result of that. So all of this serves to bypass existing public caching and resolution infrastructure, but still let us use our existing software, which is a very useful way of bypassing censorship and so on. So to give you a bit more flavor about what this looks like on the edge, it's a really beautiful interface, because whenever I do a DNS lookup on an edge device, well, the first problem is it takes time to figure out how to connect to different networks. So for example, if I'm trying to connect to my iPad and it's behind a remote NAT somewhere, I need to NAT punch, I need to send a series of packets. But the DNS protocol lets me just do multiple requests. And every time I do a request, it gives me back more and more responses as the signpost infrastructure figures out exactly how to connect. And so this is exactly what Google, for example, do right now. They redirect you to the nearest node based on your resolver. We just do this on a personal level, including setting up tunnels and so on. The second thing is that we can also bootstrap keys between devices. Because in this edge network, the other big hassle of setting up tunnels is key management. So who here has successfully set up a VPN at any point in terms of IPsec and Linux and so on? Who's tried and kind of ripped their hair? I used to have an afro before I tried to set up VPNs. The big problem is it's just a shocking state of how hard it is to set up routing infrastructure on the internet. If you try to use IPsec, you have to deal with key management and daemons that don't really interact very well with other things like SSH or deal with other things like SOX proxies. It's very hard and very manual. So crucially, because we're starting from this DNSSEC trust anchor, we can start deriving keys for all of our devices and start transcoding between them. So whenever I do a lookup, no matter what mechanism I'm using to communicate across these tunnels, the user never has to type in a password. It's all derived from your kind of internalized root of trust. And the other thing is that it's a graceful degradation. So in an ideal world, we'll all have this beautiful meshnet that Shadi just presented. Hopefully no one's getting arrested. And we'll all be communicating on the edge. But in the event that stops working, for example, I go remote and I leave the edge of that mesh service, well, I can just degrade to tunneling over my personal service in the cloud, or going to a shared provider, for example, like Google or Dropbox, to start tunneling data over. The DNS service can simply take care of managing that interface. The actual act of resolution, the gory details, which I'm not going to go into detail in this talk, starts running a number of shell scripts, essentially. And what these shell scripts do is that they start probing the network. They try to SSH to the other endpoint. They try to set up IPsec. They try to set up OpenVPN, or indeed set up Privoxy or Tor via SOX proxies. A lot of times, these will just fail, because you just don't know until you try if there's a firewall in the way that's blocking a particular proxy. But the ones that do succeed tell the signpost they've succeeded, and then they'll respond back, and then they'll be replied to as one of the IP addresses in the responses. So all of these are done in the signpost network on behalf of the user with no particular configuration required beyond running the service. One of the problems here you might have noticed is that this does require you to modify the edge device. It is possible, and we have prototyped this at extreme pain, is use OpenFlow to start doing intelligent edge redirection of various services. It's not kind of satisfying right now because OpenFlow is not widely deployed, but in a few years when, for example, macOS supports it, maybe in the future when iPhones and things support it, this is a nice kind of use of software-defined networking at the edge of the network. But for now, we do require you to modify the device or have a trusted network in between the device. The reason we're really using security is to try to figure out identity management. This is something we just need to nail before we deploy the service into production. One of the properties that this whole signpost network has is that it provides us with a way to internalize our keys. So a number of other services, for example, Persona and Mozilla, OpenID, require you to run a network service that requires quite a lot of infrastructure. DNS, on the other hand, is actually really standalone. But it's surprising that no one in the security community has come up with a way to transcode keys between all of these different services. For example, I have SSH keys, PGP keys, DNS serve keys, Of course, DNSSEC keys. And I want to try to figure out how I can migrate secrets between these things. But if we can do that, if we can gracefully just start with a DNSSEC root of trust or some other root of trust and move between all of these other services, it lets us manage revocation and key management for all of our network services in one place. So we've got a bunch of mechanisms for doing this, but we just really wanted to open this up to auditing. So we're going to be around and really keen to chat to people about the specifics of, for example, interfacing DNS curve with DNSSEC, if anyone's interested in having a chat about that. One of the nice things that's come out of this is really experimenting how to build services, like a program model around programming these personal cloud services. So if anyone's ever built a network service, you know that the first thing you do in POSIX is that you call getAdderInfo to resolve a DNS name. Then this gives you back a set of IP addresses, and then you just pick a random IP address. Address selection is kind of it's a bit magic, and then you connect to actually connect to that IP address. So there's a few obvious problems with this. The first one is that you only do one DNS lookup, but if this is a long-lived connection, the whole network might have changed. You might be mobile. There might be a new middle box in the way. You never quite know what happened. So with signposts, we try to couple naming and flow resolution. So whenever you bind a name to a flow, the application gets regular callback. For example, a new path is available, or a new set of congestion properties just opened up. And then the signpost nodes, the network nodes, attempt to select the best environmentally possible path. Moving between sockets and the signpost APIs is where a lot of the system level hacks are, because we need to add all these shims in place in order to let the applications be aware without explicitly modifying them of the fact that there's a whole bunch of network management going on. And the specific way we do that, I won't go into detail again, is simply that we proxy DNS on localhost, we return fake IP addresses, and we only actually do the DNS lookups whenever real traffic is sent to those fake IP addresses. So this way, if I return, for example, 10.1.2.3, which is a localhost fake address, only when a SYN packet goes on that at a particular port, we can then figure out the full URL for the lookup, because I will know that I tried to look up, for example, recall.org. I then try to send a SYN packet on port 80 with this particular frame, down that packet, so I can figure out the fact that I was actually doing a service lookup for port 80 for HTTP. So it really lets applications get a lot more information about what their programming requirements are. So lots of the system are kind of coming into place right now. We have, for example, DNS curve implementations and DNSSEC implementations, but there's certain key things that are still to be resolved, and this is probably one of those things that's only resolved by open sourcing it and just deploying it to the wild and figuring out what works. The first thing is it's really hard to figure out which path to use. The networking protocols we use haven't really figured out address selection. They've helped us with multipath TCP and so on, but if given a set of choices, you kind of have no choice, but you just try it all. And one thing I'd be curious to know is if the mesh network work has figured out this path selection problem, how do you know, is there a cost model for figuring out which route you want to go down? For example, if you have a chargeable 3G network, you probably don't want to use that. You want to use your wireless network, unless the wireless network is being very slow. I talked about identity already, but we're also we use a programming language called OCaml for all of our services. So we're exploring the programming model in a more functional sense, and then distilling those down to C APIs. One of the things that people might be interested in is that while we're building this work, you had to do lots and lots of network hacking to experiment with all of these little services. We actually ended up building an operating system. So the operating system is called Open Mirage, and it's a library operating system. So the idea is that all of the services you build end up as libraries written in OCaml, including TCP/IP, SSH, DNS, there's 80 of these things. And then they compile into tiny little microkernels that can run on ARM or Zen microkernels directly in the cloud. And so Open Mirage will give you more information about that. But one of the interesting things here is that it's really nice to be able to distill down the mechanisms of doing all this network work, for example, sending TCP packets and separating from conventional operating systems. So we no longer have to live in this Linux land of trying to battle with the network stack. We can actually just build our own kernels and actually deploy them in the cloud, and then they're fully type safe, they're tiny, and they're fully under our control because it's a library-based operating system. So that was at ASPOS last year. So some of the implications of this, I've given you kind of a whirlwind tour of this kind of fairly big system because I wanted to give you a feel for what's implied in building one of these big DNS things. Of course, a lot of this complexity can and should be hidden from the end user. But what it gives us most crucially, I think, is the ability to have a DNS-based system where we control the endpoint and the network resolution. So this means that we can actually start migrating away from the existing DNS once these systems are deployed. So once I use recall.org and I'm still using applications that use DNS, I can say, well, stop doing DNS resolution for other people. Start doing peer-to-peer DNS resolution instead. And my signpost will switch away from that and start using alternative systems such as Perspectives and Namecoin, although Namecoin has fairly fundamental issues. But Perspectives, for example, is a really interesting peer-to-peer DNS. But we can actually deploy this with signposts without having to modify any of the edge devices, because signposts kind of act as that proxy to hide a lot of the complexities. With wide deployment, the network effect behind signposts is, this is pure speculation now, but it really does help you with setting up more of a peer-to-peer network of resolution. Because as soon as you know, for example, my social graph or the style of DNS lookups I do, well, hooking into Tor is actually very, very straightforward. So we've experimented with adding a .tor domain that's a magic domain. So if I want to go to Google anonymously, I go to www.google.com.tor, and that acts as a predicate that is stripped away by the DNS infrastructure, and then and the signpost routes you through a Tor switch instead. There's various issues with that, for example, URL rerouting and so on, but the basic idea is actually quite easy for people to grasp. And there's also really interesting anonymous systems for descent from Yale and many, many more to count that can be hooked into to this sort of system. So I've given you this kind of whirlwind tour. There's code coming up. We're actually hacking furiously and getting this code, and we'll do an open source release really quite soon. We have things like the local DNS proxies working. We have the OpenFlow switches. We have a lot of the components in place, but the overall system is still coming together because obviously as we deploy it just for ourselves, we find all kinds of compatibility issues. But these two places are kind of the places to follow on GitHub, or just keep an eye on Hacker News or the usual places for the release announcements. But overall, though, I hope this has given you a feel for what we're working on, and I'd love to take questions now.
You're talking about binding PGP and SSH through DNSSEC.
Yep.
But there are already well-defined ways to put an SSH fingerprint or a PGP key in DNS.
Yeah, so for example, the SSHFP was one of the earliest ways, if I remember right. We're just trying to automate this. So whenever I register a device, if this device, for example, publishes an SSH server like my Mac, then right now it's a very manual process. I've got to take my very secure DNSSEC keys. I've then got to add a SSHFP record. I've got to do all this in a fairly manual way. This is all pretty easy until you get to revocation, because let's say I get my Mac stolen, I have to revoke all of the keys across this infrastructure. So what we're trying to do with this unified identity management is to contain all these things and automate the translation between these systems. So I don't even want to have to generate a host key for SSH. I want to automatically just say, here's a new Mac, it's got a host key, give it a host key, make sure it's signed and bound to this particular DNSSEC root. And then just take a revocation from you. So it's all really all about automation in a sense. Yep. But it's very nice because when you do recompile, for example, SSH with SHFP, you just never see another host key warning or anything again, because it's all just taking, the support is already in the applications, which is very encouraging, but only for very few. XMPP, SSH, it hasn't really taken off for IMAP or any of these other services, so I think that'll just take time.
So in Tor, we used to have a .exit domain that we used, and the idea was to let the user be able to say, I want to go to google.com.germany.exit, for example.
Right.
And we would be sort of mushing together the destination with the routing requests.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up dropping it because of the privacy security issues, where you go to a website, and they give you an image link to google.com.iceland.exit, and suddenly they're influencing what you're going to do for the next request and maybe for requests after it if you end up reusing apps. So what are the problems? Here you are mushing names with how to get to them and so on.
This is a really good point. So there's always been this implicit assumption that names are a matter of public record. So for example, in log files and so on, there's nothing particularly secret about a name. So we've been quite careful to avoid putting capabilities into the domain name. For example, having a big hash .recall.org. Except internally for short-lived stuff. I think we will almost certainly drop this whole predicate DNS idea of putting a .tor at the end of DNS, because while it seems to work on the surface, there's just too many issues, because the HTTP request, for example, has in the host header the .tor, and you have to rewrite that. So you have to be very aware of the subsequent use of that name in the protocol in order to do a good job of doing anything with it. In terms of the rest of it, it actually works fine, because the signpost resolution instructor server side takes care of all of these choices. So I simply type in a name, their services associate subsequent traffic to that name with a flow, for example, an HTTP or an SSH or IPsec tunnel, whatever that is, and they take care of the management. So they can then apply a privacy policy based on what you want. There's one good example of this. If I want to publish, so we're brainstorming about what is a good application to use here, and one is a location-aware DNS service. So there's a DNS record for your location. So in this world, if I want my friend David there to do a lookup for my location of my iPhone, then he can do a DNS lookup, and my signpost server will make a decision whether or not he should get my real address or kind of a fuzzed fake GPS address. But all of this just happens in the network without the edge devices really seeing it. So this means that the network can make a choice about privacy without having to propagate that back to the user. And it's very similar to Tor. If I want to avoid a certain exit node because I think it might be compromised, my Tor proxy can make those source routing decisions without it being exposed to anyone else. They're strictly in my domain, right? And not beholden to anyone else.
Except if somebody else can make you choose to visit a given website or a different given website, they can control what your private, what it appears you selected as your privacy choices to your local DNS.
So the big difference here is that DNS is authenticated on both sides. So whenever I do a lookup to ipad.ildrick.org, it also knows who's making that request.
And your browser's making the request because you clicked on it.
Yes.
Or your browser auto-loaded it because it... We should talk about this after.
Yeah, no, you are completely correct, actually. So there's essentially a bunch of... if the only thing the browser can get back to you is an IP address that doesn't leak too much information, then you're fine. It is a serious concern if you're getting back additional information over the DNS. For example, the location example I just gave you. So this is something that we need to think about very, very carefully. So I'd probably move towards I'm confident this will work for convenience, but not for any kind of security critical thing at the same time. You're completely correct.
So let's have the final speaker set up while we entertain one last question. There are none. Let's take our speaker.
Great. Thanks for your time.